Hello, and welcome back to Trumpet World. We've reached the anniversary of October 7th and the terrorist attack that Hamas launched on Israel last year. Since then, a lot has changed in Israel, in the wider Middle East, and in the world as a whole. Where have we come in a year of terrorism, of war, of new alliances, and old partnerships breaking? Well, we have two interviews lined up for today's episode of two figures with different perspectives on how the war has impacted the wider Middle East and the world as a whole. For our first interview today, we have Tal Orcohen Montemayor, the founder and CEO of Cyberwell, an Israeli company that analyzes content for anti-Semitism for worldwide for some of the biggest social media companies on the internet. Talor, thank you for being here.
Hey, nice to meet you.
I was wondering if maybe you could just introduce with what your history is with Cyberwell, what you do, everything that the organization was up to before October 7th.
Cyberwell is the first ever open database of online anti-Semitism. We launched in May 2022, launching the first ever open database of online anti-Semitism to give a clear picture of the state of Jew hatred online, but with an added value of looking at that data through the lens of digital policy compliance. So looking at this from the perspective of how do we actually empower social media platforms to better enforce their own rules when it comes to online anti-Semitism. And I like to say that after our launch, our first kind of proof of concept was actually the Kanye West incident, which at the time was kind of the worst of our problems in online anti-Semitism, kind of celebrity-led online anti-Semitism, where we saw that incident trigger a significant spike in different anti-Semitic narratives online. And we were able to supply the social media platforms with real-time alerts on how this specific incident triggered different anti-Semitic trends on their platforms. So since that time, we've been onboarded as a trusted partner of major social media platforms, including Meta, covering Facebook and Instagram and Threads, and including TikTok as well. So what we're doing is not only giving real-time alerts to the state of online anti-Semitism, which has been, unfortunately, a hot flash issue in recent times, but we're also giving specific analysis on how the rules of the social media platforms can better be enforced.
With that, I take it most of that reputation was pretty solid before October of last year, that there was a lot of healthy back and forth dialogue, that there weren't, say, too many conflicts of interest with the work that Cyberwell was doing.
Well, the state of online anti-Semitism has been an issue for years, actually. The reason that I started Cyberwell was because I was working in the business intelligence and open source intelligence space, and I saw a very clear migration of deeply anti-Semitic conspiracy theories and memes and images, but really hateful content from the dark corners of the internet to our mainstream everyday social media platforms. And the difference between these dark corners of the internet and the mainstream platforms is, of course, the audience. The major social media platforms make up over half of the worldwide internet activity. And as a student of history and of the Holocaust, I saw this and was very much reminded of the way that mass media was mobilized to kind of broadcast anti-Semitism before the Holocaust happened during the Third Reich. There is no society that can participate in widespread violent anti-Semitism without being primed with that idea of the conspiracy theory of Jew hatred before that incident. And that's really how I saw the major social media platforms actually becoming at great risk for doing just that, for broadcasting online anti-Semitism for millions and millions of people. So I'm also a lawyer, and I kind of thought to myself, well, what if we took a technological solution and this added level of digital policy compliance and combined that into one? And that's how Cyberwell started. Unfortunately, it was the right place in the right time because since the launching of Cyberwell, we've actually seen a tremendous increase in online anti-Semitism following October 7th, which I characterize as the most successful hijacking of our social media platforms by a terrorist group. Cyberwell tracked an 86% increase, almost a doubling in online anti-Semitism in the 3 weeks following the attack. And what was unique about the content that was flooding the online space at this time is that it was decidedly more violent. Calls to violence, including calls to young Muslims to come over the border into Israel and take up arms in order to kill as many Jews as possible. And this type of flood of anti-Semitic content online is now being felt very much directly in the streets, in the communities that Jews live in public institutions. But more importantly, I don't think that we've had enough of a healthy conversation in terms of what is the role that social media plays in fueling this violence against our community. And we see that the level of violent anti-Semitism is still higher now online than it was prior to October 7th. And more importantly, that the discourse has taken a more decidedly hostile turn against Jews online.
Yeah, so going back to October 7th, this is obviously when we're recording at the 1 year anniversary of the attack. We have a much clearer picture now with different bits of information filtering in on what Hamas was planning on doing, what some of the circumstances surrounding it are. As you mentioned, though, like in the weeks or the few days immediately afterwards, there's obviously a lot of people didn't really know what was going on, what all of this meant. And I'm sure this was reflected in some of the stuff that you guys were picking up. And how was Facebook and some of these other organizations, with all the unknowns going on, how did they respond to what people were saying, what they were allowing people to say, etc.?
So the issue with social media platforms, and I think really 1 year after October 7th, we should take pause and think, what can we learn about our safety overall as Western democracies that have these very powerful algorithmically enhanced machines that were effectively hijacked by a terrorist group on Hamas, by Hamas on October 7th? And what does that mean, right? Just like after 9/11 today, if you would go through any airport security, you know that you're removing your shoes, you're taking out your liquids from your bags. Why? Because we learned something on the day of that attack. And I don't feel like there's been the same kind of taking stock when it comes to the way that social media platforms can be used as a weapon of psychological warfare. What we saw on October 7th with the major social media platforms is that they were used as a weapon of terror by Hamas to broadcast deeply gory snuff, essentially, of their attack on the Israeli civilian population. This perpetuated the attack far beyond time and space, which is the element of using these social media platforms as a tool of psychological warfare. But then, very interestingly, Cyberwell actually tracked an October 7th denial campaign that started as early as October 8th, as early as the next day, where you saw accounts that only had a few thousand followers were located in the Middle East and places in Lebanon, tweeting out denial content that October 7th never happened or didn't happen quite the way that the news was reporting on it. And we saw those accounts suddenly being amplified and gaining millions and millions of views. In fact, in a 300-piece data set of content that Cyberwell vetted as October 7th denial in the first month following the October 7th attack, that denial content reached 25 million people. So you're talking about the large platforming of a major disinformation campaign after one of the largest attacks on the Jews since the Holocaust. Now, think about what that could mean for any Western democracy today that's under the threat of a terrorist attack. And the FBI has come out with multiple statements saying that there is a higher level or higher imminent risk of an ISIS attack in the United States now more than ever. I don't feel like there is a clear understanding of what are the safety precautions do we want to put on social media platforms in order to make sure that they don't become weapons of psychological warfare and misinformation and disinformation campaigns on the eve of a terror attack. Now, you asked about how the social media platforms reacted. It was exactly that. It was reactionary. It was temporary. Temporarily, there was a lot more effort in content moderation. Temporarily, they set up task force, but where are the takeaways? What are the best practices to ensure that a hijacking of our social media platforms never happens again? And I think that at this point, it's an issue of national security, and every Western government should be interested in what are the social media platforms doing in order to ensure it never happens again.
But with the reaction, as you were talking about, do you find at least the people that you're talking to, the people that are implementing maybe some of your recommendations, do you feel like they're sympathetic to what they're combating, or are they treating it as a non-issue, or how is the, do you think they're taking it seriously enough?
I think that there are good people at every platform, and Cyberwell is a trusted partner of most major social media platforms today. And we work directly with those social media platforms to empower better enforcement of their existing policies and even improving their policies to account for modern forms of anti-Semitism. So, for example, as a result of the widespread abuse of the term Zionist on social media platforms to actually spread anti-Semitism, Meta has recently updated their policy to recognize that that is a proxy term for speaking about Jews online. And so too, TikTok has as well. Cyberwell was involved in providing data to that decision-making process and is still providing examples to actually train the classifiers online on how to identify that information, right? So I do think that there are efforts, but typically those efforts are really focused on things that are coming too late. Right, they're reacting to a crisis situation. The update is typically happening on a policy level when, in fact, we should be leveraging technology to implement these policies at scale more effectively. And I also want to point out when it came to the October 7th denial campaign, this is something that Cyberwell has been focused on since October 7th because we saw this campaign happen and we saw that the rates of removal at the time by the social media platforms were at 9% after reporting, so far below the average of what we would expect to see. And as I mentioned, an active misinformation and disinformation campaign that very much mimics the conspiratorial thinking of Holocaust deniers, right? Now, the thing is, the social media platforms actually had policies on the books that should have addressed this type of content. It's called violent event denial policy. It applies to not only the Holocaust, but also to the Sandy Hook school shooting, also to the Rwanda genocide. Technically speaking, it should have been really easy to look at the policy or the guidebook and say, this is violative content and we're going to remove it. But that didn't happen. It was platformed for millions of people and it fueled hate and justified radical, aggressive tactics against the Jewish community in the anti-Israel demonstrations and became a threat to public safety. When I was talking to some of the contacts at these major social media platforms, I was told, well, October 7th denial doesn't have any real-world harm. That was a reaction from them. Okay. So, and then what happens? Literally, just a couple of weeks after that conversation, there were two incidents of rape, revenge rape, anti-Semitic rape in France, both on a 12-year-old girl and on a 30-some-year-old woman who was kidnapped and raped as revenge. One of the major narratives of the October 7th denial campaign was that rape never happened during October 7th. Meanwhile, Susan Sarandon was also stopped on the street and said, that's propaganda. It never happened. So there is a real world harm to these misinformation and disinformation campaigns. And the social media platforms are relying on third party fact checkers who have no KPIs, no quality assurance. The third party fact checkers can literally choose what piece of content they want to fact check, and it's done on a manual level, not any kind of way at scale, not any way that's using technology to actually effectively implement these policies. So, since Cyberwell's work on October 7th denial, TikTok actually went on the record as being the first social media platform to recognize that October 7th denial was prohibited content. And since that decision happened, we've seen the rates of removal go up exponentially and are now at about 40%, which is closer to the average of what we would expect to see for online anti-Semitism. But it took 6 months to get there, right? And that's the problem. The social media platforms have a unique responsibility because they are the masters of these algorithmically charged machines that are spreading information, not only speech, information that also fuels hate and also fuels extremist action. And that is what we have seen since October 7th online. And we've seen that translate directly to targeting the Jewish community in different diaspora places, the United States, Europe, of course. Anti-Semitic incidents are up, increasing by 200%. Over 61% of Jews, according to the Combat Anti-Semitism Movement statistics, have experienced anti-Semitism directly since October 7th. And when we have this information about incidents, violent incidents, people being confronted with hatred, bigotry, and discrimination in places that they were otherwise safe, it kind of shocks the system. But for me, as somebody who's been looking at the way that social media platforms have been broadcasting this Jew hatred to millions of people since October 7th, it's no surprise. What's happening online is directly spilling out over into the streets and making it unsafe for Jewish communities today.
Now, of course, there's two sides, I guess you could say, to anti-Semitism online. There's the putting up actual content or incitement to violence or whatever, and then there's also perhaps covering up footage that people have, say, of anti-Semitic protests and riots in certain places to try and make, I guess, the opposition look not as bad as they actually are. Have you seen, from what you've been able to tell, much on that side of the equation as well?
Well, we definitely saw there were active efforts to cover the response, a lot of the BDS movement specifically, that was there to amplify and support the attacks of Hamas as early as October 7th. These people were organizing and amplifying and even borrowing imagery from the attack itself, including infamously the paraglider, the motorized paragliders that came in over the border in order to execute this mass terrorist attack. And that became a symbol for the BDS movement globally in order to organize protests in support of these attacks. And I think that this is going directly to another trend that we've very much seen in online spaces since October 7th, which is the normalization and platforming of pro-terror content. And again, exactly what we've seen online and the failure of the social media platforms to systematically and effectively enforce what's known as their dangerous organizations and individuals or their anti-terror policies online. We now see that in the streets. We see that by people showing up with Hezbollah flags, with Hezbollah shirts, with impunity, as you said, including Hamas, including the spokesperson of Hamas, Abu Ubaida, which has become a popular kind of iconicized figure online. We also see this with a very clear trend of the use of the red triangle, which is used as it's a target symbol coming directly from Hamas propaganda to identify where there is a Israeli or a Jewish target, a casualty, a future casualty from their propaganda videos. This red triangle directly from Hamas terror propaganda has now been normalized and is being used widespread in online spaces. And also in the anti-Israel encampments and riots. And that has now turned into literally bringing in threats for domestic terrorism. In opposition to Bibi's Netanyahu speech in Washington, D.C., some months ago, the red triangle was spray painted in Union Station with the threat Hamas is coming. The same red triangle has been vandalized numerous times in different Jewish communities, including the Squirrel Hill Jewish community that was targeted in the Tree of Life shooting. So this symbol, because of social media platforms, has now jumped from very secluded pro-terror propaganda channels to our mainstream everyday social media platforms and is now being used actively, domestically, by these protesters to threaten domestic terrorism. And where is the government interest saying, what are you doing about the red triangle? What are you doing about Hezbollah symbols? What are you doing about Hamas symbols online, right? Everything that we're seeing in the streets, you could see a precursor to it being normalized and platformed on the major social media platforms.
You mentioned earlier comparisons with what's going on now and some of the information war immediately before the Holocaust. Now, obviously, that was very organized and coordinated. Do you see whether it's through organizations or even state actors some kind of similar coordination, or would you say this is mostly grassroots?
The fantastic question. As you said, during the Third Reich, and I think Deborah Lipstadt, who's the ambassador for combating anti-Semitism in the United States, said this the best. The difference between what we see in anti-Semitism today versus the Third Reich is that that was state-sponsored anti-Semitism, including in the forms of mass communication. Today, what you see is algorithmically charged anti-Semitism on the mainstream social media platforms. And the people who are organizing the abuse of our social media platforms are both organizations that have foreign funding and also the countries themselves. As I mentioned, Cyberwell's primary focus following October 7th has been looking and examining the October 7th denial campaign online. There were multiple indicators that there was inauthentic behavior, meaning the amplification of bots. Suddenly, somebody with only a few thousand followers gets October 7th denial content tweeted out regularly on their account. Now they're getting millions of views on one tweet, right? That's a big indicator for inauthentic behavior. So I'll say that what we can say for sure is that the anti-Semitism today is algorithmically charged anti-Semitism. The people who are abusing our algorithmic machines are without a doubt both organizations and foreign state actors. The question then becomes, what is the responsibility of the social media platforms? And what is the responsibility of the governments of the Western democracies who love free speech, but can see that the writing is on the wall in terms of the abuse of these platforms for normalizing pro-terror content, normalizing hate content that leads very much to targeting of their communities, and misinformation and disinformation campaigns that are meant and are designed to sow unrest, destruction, and destabilize a society? The problem is that the government feels like they can't step in here, but they absolutely can. We haven't even begun to scratch the surface on different solutions that we have here in our legislational arsenal. People talk about the fact that Section 230 is a sinkhole. In fact, it is. It's been tried to be reformed in the United States about 20 odd times in the last 2 years, and Congress has failed to do any reform thought around Section 230. But there are multiple other legislational solutions that we can borrow from that are focused on transparency, that are focused on regulating, just like you would regulate how quickly a stock is traded on the market, right? There are limitations to that in order to prevent price manipulation. Same thing can happen when it comes to content virality. So, this is a moment a year after October 7th, not only to examine the horrific attack, but look at the way that our mainstream social media platforms, our favorite apps, were abused by a terror organization and ask ourselves, what should we be doing to make sure that doesn't happen again?
With that, I mean, obviously, there's even before October 7th happened, quite a few, I guess you could say, perennial sources of this kind of disinformation that wouldn't be too surprising, like the BDS movement you just mentioned, or like news organizations like Al Jazeera. With everything that's gone on with October 7th, with the new spotlight that Israel has, with the new, I guess you could say, impetus a lot of, people in high places have to comment on this or to involve themselves in Israel's war effort. Has your research found any surprising sources of this kind of disinformation that we wouldn't have expected otherwise?
Well, I personally wouldn't have expected for Al Jazeera to be one of the main trumpets of the October 7th denial campaign. October 7th denial is today's modern form of Holocaust denial. The major narratives claim that rape and sexual violence didn't happen, claim that Israel actually orchestrated the attack or that they were behind the attack. Why? Because ultimately they're profiting from it. And Al Jazeera, which is one of the most influential news sources in the Middle East, if not in the world, actually tweeted out on the Al Jazeera Arabic account when Israel did something unprecedented and released the picture of two small children who were burnt alive by Hamas. They tweeted out that that was an AI-generated image. Okay, so there is not only a lack of accountability and a lack of clarity on what do we expect from social media platforms in this, and but what do we expect from our traditional media platforms, traditional media outlets for tweeting out this type of misinformation and disinformation. So absolutely, that is an issue that we have seen. Obviously, it was very surprising to see, specifically with the Al-Alhi Baptist Hospital explosion, that was that because of social media, quite literally, was wrongfully attributed to Israel, and it turned out that that was a misfire from a Palestinian Islamic Jihad rocket. Our major news sources, because of the race to the bottom, with being first with the story. Incorrectly, also in their major headlines, attributed that to Israel. And what was interesting to see is when that happened, when the New York Times falsely put out that headline along with other major news sources, we saw online that that triggered a spike in online anti-Semitism. Hashtag Hitler was right trended, spiking upwards on Twitter right after that that misinformation incident, and specifically in Arabic, it had increased by 29,000%. So the weight and the power of misinformation and disinformation, and the way that it's spreading in an active conflict via the social media platforms, is very much part of triggering anti-Semitism both online and offline.
And what do you th would say be the end game if this is coordinated? If there are people investing lots of money, lots of time, lots of resources into getting this going, it's obviously a lot more than just like hate-filled random people here and there venting their thoughts. Is it to pressure governments to do more to marginalize Israel, or is it just to sow terror, pure and simple, or is there any other motivation?
Well, I want to stick to my expertise, which is online anti-Semitism. Absolutely, Ron has said very openly, with the export of very radical Islamic Jihad to the world, that part of that campaign is to delegitimize Israel. And that has been the goal of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, the BDS movement, since day one. I think that it's up to the Western democracies, who respect free speech and respect concerns about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Those concerns are legitimate concerns. Bringing attention to those concerns is fine. And I'm saying that as an Israeli, right? But when you're platforming and you're celebrating genocidal attacks by a terror organization, not only has the BDS movement and those who are following it lost the plot, it's now up to Western democracies to understand that this is a national security threat for their countries, and to make it very clear what their plans are for dealing with those people. Even the arrests that have been made in the anti-Israel encampments, I think over 50% of them have resulted in no action. Okay, so why, if these people are literally supporting a pro-terror movement, that's a national security concern for the United States. But we cannot ignore the role that social media platforms are playing in platforming and broadcasting this pro-terror content, misinformation, and hate speech that is ultimately activating these groups.
Of course, it's also one thing for bots or whoever to put this kind of content out there or to artificially inflate the numbers. But has your statistics been able to ascertain if they've actually been having a desired effect? If there's a lot of people that maybe ordinarily wouldn't be believing this kind of material falling in line, etc.?
So it's hard to measure because that's very bespoke to somebody's algorithmic feed. But I can tell you that even if something is being falsely amplified by millions of views or millions of clicks, even if that's done by a bot, it ultimately is hijacking the algorithm, and it's going to increase the likelihood that somebody will be exposed to that misinformation and disinformation. And I mentioned the October 7th denial. Major narratives. If you stop anyone who is at an anti-Israel or pro-Palestinian rally and you talk to them about rape or sexual violence that was used on October 7th, they will tell you it didn't happen. Now, they truly believe that because that is what was shown to them on social media. It's important to understand Most people under 30 years old are using social media platforms as their primary news source, as their primary news source. Now, the law has failed to hold social media platforms to account like a publisher, but objectively speaking, socially, that's how people are looking at these platforms as publishers, as their main news source. By the way, the number one news source for most people under 30 years old, if they are citing social media, is Twitter, but TikTok has doubled in the last 2 years. And when you look at TikTok, you have something that's a very aggressive confirmation bias algorithm that was meant originally as ByteDance to keep you engaged, to show you a song, to entertain you. Well, now it's become a platform of citizen journalism. Has any kind of adjustment been done to the algorithm? Absolutely not. So what is it doing? It's continuously engaging you in things that are going to confirm your bias or confirm the way you interact with an algorithm. It's meant to entertain, not to inform. And yet, objectively speaking, it's being used by people as a news source. So it just heightens how urgent and important this issue is, and how this is no longer an issue of just online anti-Semitism or how the platforms were used to promote anti-Jewish snuff. This is a national security issue and it needs to be treated as such.
Okay, that's about all the material I had. Is there anything from your perspective that you think people out there in cyberspace aren't too aware of that they think they should know?
Yes, when we're looking at the situation of online anti-Semitism, I can share with you, we do a very clear narrative analysis. So we're not only tracking, anti-Semitism, what does that mean? I can share with you that prior to October 7th, the majority or the leading narrative that we saw in the online space were tropes about Jewish power, world domination and control, kind of classic anti-Semitic tropes. That was the leading trope that we saw online. Since October 7th, we've seen a very clear trend to overtly hostile anti-Semitic narratives characterizing Jews as the enemy and characterizing Jews as evil. And this is an escalation in terms of the way that people are thinking about the Jewish people. People are thinking hostilely about the Jewish people as something that is inherently evil and inherently an enemy that must be fought and that must be defeated. This is when we talk about the concern of the power of words in online spaces that are being shared for millions of people. It's no longer an anti-Semitism that's rooted in disdain. It's rooted in almost pseudo-religious, open hostility and belief that Jews are evil. And you asked a great question about how likely is it that this content is being effective on people? I can tell you it's being effective on Jews, right? For the majority of Jewish Americans, well over 60% of them that experienced online anti-Semitism in the last 12 months, one in three of those users, those Jewish users that experienced online anti-Semitism, will take active steps to hide their identity, both online or offline. And this has been reflective also in recent surveys released by CAM, that about a third of Jews are now taking steps to actively hide their identity. That is the indicator and the litmus test on is the online anti-Semitism really effective? Is it that big of a deal? The answer is absolutely. Not only do we see that in the massive increase of anti-Semitic incidents, but also from the experience of Jewish people themselves who are now hiding their identity, who are now doing things like opening multiple accounts, one that doesn't show their identity whatsoever, and even leaving social media altogether. This is a major cause for concern, clearly for the Jewish community, but also from a national security perspective, and it requires a vigilant inquiry into what the social media platforms are doing 1 year after October 7th.
Tyler Cohen Montemayor, thank you for coming here.
Thank you so much.
And now we have Avi Melmed, an Israeli analyst and author of Inside the Middle East. Avi, thanks for being here. So to start, if you wouldn't mind, maybe just explain to our viewers who you are, what you do, how did you get involved in this work?
Sure. So my name is Avi Melamed. I'm a former Israeli intelligence official and senior official on Arab affairs. I'm the founder of Inside the Middle East, a nonprofit institute providing apolitical, nonpartisan education about the Middle East.
Okay, so we're obviously recording on the anniversary of the October 7 terror attack that obviously caught a lot of people off guard when it happened and with the unfolding events. With everything you've seen in the Middle East, obviously Israel's been fighting Hamas, fighting Hezbollah for a long, long time, but aside from the obvious effects of an actual war, has this changed the equation of how Israel deals with its terror threats, how the radical Islamist world has been dealing with Israel, etc.?
Well, look, this whole attack, October 7, and everything that happens following up until today, as you mentioned accurately, Israel is fighting against different challenges from different regions in different levels of intensity. It's actually not a surprise for people like myself who have been professionally following the events in the region, in the Middle East, for many decades. And to a large extent, you could say that it was written on the wall. This is the what we see today is almost inevitable because the Iranian regime in Tehran basically was unfortunately able to create this network of armies of terror called the Axis of Resistance across the Middle East and to dictate to a large extent the trajectory of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict negatively. But also at the same time to inflict disaster and havoc across the Middle East, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen, and so on. So right now, what we are looking at is that this building threat on the state of Israel, but not only on the state of Israel has now been reached to the point where it's kind of like exploded, and Israel is now engaged, as you say, in fighting in the proxies of the Iranians and the Iranians themselves. Who, reminding you, launched twice during that year direct attack on Israel on April 13 and October 1st.
As you mentioned with the Axis for Resistance, the I guess you could say the proxy that everybody has their minds on right now is Hezbollah and everything that is going on in Israel's north. It seems like every day there's a new development with some high commander being assassinated or a new invasion. In your book, Inside the Middle East, Entering a New Era, which I actually have a copy of here, you wrote about pre 2021 Lebanon and some of the problems they had. This is just a quote that you wrote in there. However, as the crisis in Lebanon deepens, there is a genuine possibility that massive violence will erupt in Lebanon and the country will just be dragged into complete havoc. The fear of this scenario is palpable, and this is something that all elements in Lebanon, including Hezbollah, want to avoid. Now, back then, of course, Hezbollah was still very much in control of Lebanon. It was still probably arguably the most feared of Iran's proxies. With the recent developments, that's all come into question. Do you think that with what Israel is doing right now, a scenario just like that could happen?
But look, unless the Hezbollah was launching October 8th, starting to attack Israel by the order of the Iranians, we may have been in a different place today. But the Hezbollah basically cornered himself when the leader of Hezbollah, Nasrallah, said following October 7, he said, "I'm going to attack Israel until there will be ceasefire in Gaza Strip." And so there hasn't been a ceasefire in Gaza Strip, and Hezbollah continued to poke Israel, sort of speaking. And that process has been intensifying, basically leading right now to the point where the Hezbollah is in a place that it did not anticipate and of course didn't look for in October 6. Because up until not so long ago, Hezbollah was positioning itself as a regional power, and to a large extent accurately. Hezbollah not only took Lebanon hostage, Hezbollah is involved in the war in Yemen, he's involved in the war in Syria, he's involved in what's happening in the West Sahara. And the leaders of Hezbollah did not even try to conceal that they were bragging about it. And the Hezbollah was building itself as an image of an invincible or undefeated factor in the region. Now he's in a totally different place and a base that, to a large extent, the Hezbollah in its worst nightmares did not anticipate a year ago. And one of the interesting things that we see today in the context of Lebanon, you quoted from the book, is that in fact, now many of the Lebanese, including, by the way, many Shiites, which is the political power base of Hezbollah, many of the Lebanese are basically saying, this is our window of opportunity to restore our stolen or kidnapped sovereignty, because Hezbollah kidnapped Lebanon or took Lebanon hostage. And so it's very interesting to see how that dynamic will evolve in the year to come, following what happened to Hezbollah and following to what will be the outcome of this whole regional tensions and escalation. But right there, as we talk about Lebanon today, I would say that this is for the first time, and the Lebanese know that. This is for the first time for the last couple of decades that Lebanese says they really have a chance to finally get back their homeland and restore their sovereignty. That has to do a lot of that has to do also with the position of Western powers, to what extent they will be standing by the Lebanese people to restore their sovereignty. All I can say in that regard is one simple thing. If the Lebanese will be able to restore that sovereignty, that's a good news to Lebanon. It's a good news to Israel. It's a good news to the region.
Now, with everything happening in Lebanon, with Israel moving in, I think a lot of people were taken aback by how little resistance Hezbollah has been pushing back. I mean, the Israeli Air Force had already taken out, by some estimates, half of Hezbollah's rocket arsenal, but that still leaves tens of thousands of rockets that they could have used. But they haven't, even though at this point it seems like they have nothing left to lose. Why is Hezbollah dragging its feet so much?
Well, look, there are a couple of reasons. First, starting from a tactical, I would say, Hezbollah has been severely beaten, and particularly the impact of the deep Israeli infiltration to Hezbollah's most kept secret, assets, like the depots of the missiles, the whereabouts of its leadership. Israel took out all of the leadership of Hezbollah, literally speaking, including the Hassan Nasrallah. The impact of all those things are enormous in different aspects. Obviously, we all remember what happened with the story of the pagers attacks. So all those things, accumulatively speaking, basically shocked the Hezbollah. Though it's kind of like starting to try to get back to itself and to regain structure, it's still a very challenging task, particularly when Israel continues its strikes at Hezbollah. Now, you have mentioned accurately that Hezbollah still has, of course, significant capacities and probably will continue and try to continue part of those capacities. And there is another part of his capacities, which is, of course, the long-range missiles that the Hezbollah has, which he's not using. Because the Iranians don't give him the green light, so to speak, to use that. The fate of the Hezbollah, in the end of the day, to a large extent, is related, of course, with the story of the Iranian regime. And right now, the Iranian regime, as the whole world is kind of like bracing for what is supposed to be an upcoming Israeli response to the Iranian attack on Israel on October 1st, obviously, everybody is looking to see what will be their response, assuming there is going to be a response, because Israeli government formally said there is going to be a robust response. So what will be the outcome of that response? What will be the Iranian response to the response? So all these things are, of course, connected. And of course, one of the things that is very significant in that context is what will be the ramifications in the context of the Hezbollah continuation, as you mentioned before, to resist, quote unquote. I can tell you by now that in Hezbollah's people overtly are basically saying we don't object ceasefire, which kind of like indicates, of course, I would say the interest of the organization and the interest of the Iranians to avoid further strikes, because every day that goes by, the Hezbollah is losing more and more assets, and in parallel to that, the voices in Lebanon demanding to restore the sovereignty, those voices are being boosted and encouraged and strengthened. And for Iran and Hezbollah, the situation of Hezbollah losing its ability to continue and control Lebanon, as it has been doing for the last couple of decades, For Iran and Hezbollah, this is a bad news. So they have to navigate between those two things.
You mentioned what a lot of the Lebanese people are feeling with this. Obviously, Lebanon has had a long history of sectarian war and religious divisions, especially. One of the aspects of this that at least surprised me the most is how quiet the Lebanese forces and Samir Jaja have been with everything going on. At least from what I've seen, he seems to be more saying an attack on Lebanon and his attack on all, et cetera, even though they'd be the ones to benefit arguably most if Hezbollah would be to uproot it from power. What is the Maronite Catholic response or view in this?
Well, look, as I mentioned before, it's not a surprise. Before this whole situation, already back in what is known as the Cedar Revolution, back in 2019, when Lebanese went out to the streets, actually demanding to restore their sovereignty, actually demanding Hezbollah to disarm itself, which of course back then was totally hopeless. So obviously the Lebanese forces, so as they know, the Christian particular, when you talk about, were of course major component in this protest. But at the same time, we have to remember that the national stream, the national party, under the leadership of Aoun back then, the president of France, and his son-in-law, Gibran Bassi, they actually handed over Lebanon to the hands of the Hezbollah. They legitimized the weapon of the Hezbollah in return for the Hezbollah's consent that Aoun will be the president of Lebanon. But the interesting thing to notice, you mentioned before Samir Jarjah. Samir Jarjah not so recently made a public statement and very, very fiery rhetoric and speech, basically saying what people in the Cedar Revolution were saying, basically saying to Hezbollah, you cannot dictate your will without consulting the rest of the Lebanese. You have to be playing ball with the other Lebanese. You can't just decide whenever you want to have war or peace, which of course reflect this rejection or opposition to Hezbollah. But I think there is nothing not less significant to notion right now, and that is the fact that it's not only within the Christians and Maronites, Druze and Sunnis, but also within the Shiites themselves in Lebanon. There is now also growing voices in the leadership level of the Lebanese Shiites, who actually says to Hezbollah, it's time to end this thing because you dragged us to havoc and destruction. It's time to end it. It's time for your Hezbollah to be part of the state of Lebanon and not to be the destructor of the state of Lebanon. And this is very significant. It's coming from the Shiite circles in Lebanon themselves, including senior leaders, which, by the way, one of the most outspoken critics of the Hezbollah is the former Secretary General of Hezbollah, Subhet Fayli, that constantly basically bashed and lashed Hezbollah for dragging Lebanon to this war against the will of the Lebanese people. So it will be very interesting to see what will be the ramifications of that in the context of the hope that Lebanon will be able to restore its sovereignty.
And now with Israel moving into southern Lebanon, their, or at least the IDF's stated goals are to neutralize the threat that, for obvious reasons, Hezbollah poses on the northern border, to get rid of Hezbollah's infrastructure on the border that's hurting the communities, that's forcing the 60,000 Israelis to be refugees in their own homes. But by this point, with, again, how much of a response Hezbollah has given, it seems that at least the IDF would have an opportunity to move further north and perhaps finish Hezbollah off once and for all. Is that a likely scenario?
I don't think so. Look, Israel wants to secure the northern communities of Israel. The threat to the northern communities of Israel is basically, of course, when you look at the northern part, it's coming from Hezbollah, and it has two major aspects. One is the rocket shooting, and the other thing, which is the anti-tank missiles that the Hezbollah has been using and can use. And Israel needs to remove that threat so people could go back safely to their homes. People will not go back safely to their home knowing that you got Radwan forces of Hezbollah sitting in proximity to the border, waiting for the sign to storm Israel style October 7. And Israelis will not go back to the border to live in the communities in the north, knowing that Hezbollah is sitting in the next by Lebanese villages and pointing them with an anti-tank missiles that could hit a bus taking school kids to school. So Israel is determined to basically eliminate those two major elements of threat, meaning the Radwan forces presence next to the border and the anti-tank missiles. I don't think that Israel is going to hunt the last rockets in the hands of Hezbollah, and I don't think that Israel will hunt necessarily the missiles, the long-term missiles, the long-range missiles. I think that Israel basically focus on clearing this whole strip in proximity to the Israeli border, making sure that the threat of missiles, of anti-tank missiles, and the threat of Radwan forces is removed. And if Hezbollah will insist to continue and to shoot rockets and so on, Israel will continue to degrade more and more assets of the Hezbollah, like, for example, what Israel has been doing in the Dahiya, in the southern part of Beirut, attacking major depot of weapons and missiles of the Hezbollah that were stored in the heart of Beirut and elsewhere, like in Bekaa, in the eastern part of Lebanon. But Israel's, I think, major objective, as I said before, is to remove the threat of the Radwan forces next to the border and the threat of the anti-tank missiles.
Okay, shifting gears a little bit, obviously Hezbollah is not the only tentacle of the octopus, the Iranian octopus, you could say. There's also Syria right next door, which is obviously a big supporter of Hezbollah as well. To this point, Bashar Assad has been really dragging his feet into entering the conflict, even though Hezbollah has such a big presence in Syria, even though he is the corridor for Iran geographically to get to Hezbollah. Obviously, he has a lot of problems of his own. But Israel, of course, famously last month conducted a high-profile raid in northern Syria. It's looking more and more that Assad isn't able to keep his hands out of the conflict one way or another. Where do you see Syria going in the future with everything going on?
Well, it's very interesting you accurately mentioned it. Assad kept totally silent about what's going on with Hezbollah. And as you mentioned, given the fact that Hezbollah is one of the major reasons why Assad still is in power, you would expect Assad to come forward and, to be overtly supporting Hezbollah. And he didn't even express condolences over the killing of Nasrallah, to the best of my knowledge. So there is, of course, reasons for that. There are reasons for that. Look, one thing that has been very clear was that Assad was not willing and doesn't want to be dragged into a wide conflict in Israel because apparently understands that that may be resulting in the end of its rule. So this is one thing. But I think that also there has been accumulative information in the last year indicating that Assad is looking for ways to a little bit loosen, sort of speaking, the Iranian hug. So he's kind of like in between, dependent on the Iranians on one hand, and on the other hand, there is some sort of an interest of Assad maybe to loosen a little bit this Iranian hug. Part of that, by the way, is fueled, I think, by sentiments of resentment and discontent among the Alawites in Syria, who are not so happy with the presence of the Iranians in parts of their areas. I think this is one of the things that fuels this Assad, sort of like intention to kind of like move away a little bit from the Iranian hug. Also, in the background of those things, of course, is the whole Arab rapprochement that was given, Arab rehabilitation that was given formally to Assad when he participated in the Arab League and was welcomed back to the Arab world. But up until now, that rehabilitation was not translated into the massive investments that Assad was hoping to see coming from Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates. One other thing which is very interesting to notice in the context of what's going on right now in Syria is that, in parallel to the massive blow that Hezbollah sustained, the Free Syrian Army kind of like starting again to reappear, sort of speaking, and also other factors of the rebels that actually are kind of like probably looking at it as a moment of momentum for them. And then there is another significant component that we have to follow, and this is, of course, Turkey, and to see what will be the ramifications of that in the context of the relationship between Erdogan and Assad, which has been kind of like going up and down during the last couple of years. So it will be very interesting to see how things will evolve in Syria. Clearly, the Iranians are trying to maintain and even increase their presence and hold in Syria. So it will be very interesting to see what will be down the road, the ramification of what is now clearly the weakening of the Hezbollah, and in parallel to that, the weakening of the Mullah regime.
Yes, yeah, so you mentioned in your book that this is another quote, the linchpin of this Iranian ecosystem is Iran's agents and proxies. They are also the Achilles heel of the mullah's hegemonic endeavor. And you said later that the most vital link in this ecosystem of proxies is Syria. It looks very likely that Hezbollah, at the very least, would be having some restructuring coming up, if not outright revolution in Lebanon, as you mentioned. You mentioned that Assad has been trying to loosen the hug. If Hezbollah loses its power and authority, that would probably be an impetus for that. With how Iran has been responding to the ongoing war, it's mainly been trying to keep up its relationship as the head of the Axis of Resistance to send missiles across the Arabian Peninsula to attack Israel directly. But if there, through different circumstances, we could see Lebanon and or Syria start, because of the war, to break away from Iran's grip, do you think we might see more active Iranian involvement in trying to clean up the damage?
It's an open question. I mean, to a large extent, it depends upon the Western powers' position. And I do hope that this whole year and all these dramatic events, once and for all, will make the Western policymakers, I wouldn't say internalize, because I think they knew, Western policymakers knew about the threat the Iranians are presenting. But I hope that it will kind of like once and for all, make the Western policymakers to apply much more decisive, non-compromising, and even tough policy vis-a-vis the story of the threat that the Mullah regime is presenting to the region. It is to a large extent, what we see right now is a window of opportunity to generate a significant change in the very unstable reality of the Middle East, that to a large extent, and particularly when you're talking about Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Gaza, was dictated by the Iranians and the axis of proxies. This is a moment or opportunity to change that course, and to start building conditions for a much more stable reality, and conditions on the ground. But it requires a very clear, decisive, non-compromising Western powers policy vis-a-vis the Iranian regime, vis-a-vis the threat that it presents. I mean, global economy has been significantly damaged following the attacks of Houthis in the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. So this is the time also for Western powers to step in and to really take much more robust, decisive actions and decisions vis-a-vis the Iranians, basically to manifest the fact that this is a moment of change. The game rules are now changed, and this is the moment to start moving towards hopefully more stable reality on the ground. But this is an open question. I wish I could say decisively that I think that this is going to happen. I don't know to say that necessarily. We'll have to see how things will evolve.
Who do you think would be most likely as a country or a group of countries to come in and step and say, help Hezbollah out or reconstruct Lebanon or Syria or anything like that?
Well, look, the Iranian regime clearly will try to restore as much as possible, as quickly as possible, its control over Lebanon through the Hezbollah and also its ability to continue to dictate the fueling the flames of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because this is the interest of the Iranian regime. So, as far as the Iranian regime is concerned, it's definitely expected that it will try to do all those things to rebuild quickly as possible Hezbollah and Hamas and others. And that's exactly the point where we talked about the Western powers and the need for them to come in between and to make sure that it's not going to happen.
Well, I meant more if, say, if there was a revolution and, say, Lebanon starts looking for foreign backers, like, do you think they would ask the EU to maybe come and get involved, or Turkey, or some other group like that?
Look, if you're looking at a scenario of an inner Lebanese power struggle, violent power struggle, you could of course take into consideration the involvement of outer powers. Turkey is definitely one possible option because there is a large Sunni population in the northern part of Lebanon, even though I'm not so sure that Turkey will rush to deal with this hot potato. But this is one example. We have to think about involvement of Western powers like France, that has a very long, deep connections to Lebanon, and particularly the Christians in Lebanon, the United States. In other words, if there would be such a scenario, that would be a moment of a test for the decisiveness of Western powers to open a new page in the story of the region, in the sense that not allowing Iran to continue and to dictate the fate and trajectory of the region. And so, potentially, yes, we could see, of course, a situation where such powers would be involved. I don't necessarily see the Iranians directly involved in such a scenario to save Hezbollah. They will try, of course, other ways to put handles of pressures different ways, not necessarily in Lebanon, but elsewhere. They will apply probably the same tactic that they have been applying to try to save Hamas following October 7 by activating their different proxies in different parts of the region. But the Iranian regime has a very significant feature, and that is that the Iranian regime has been very gladly sacrificing everybody else other than the Iranians themselves. So I don't see necessarily that this feature is going to be changed.
One last question. With an uptick in unrest in the area, speaking of Europe, what's probably on a lot of people's minds is that if Lebanon or Syria or some of these other areas in the north were to become more volatile, more active fighting, there's a chance that the refugee crisis could uptick again and we could start seeing hundreds of thousands of refugees heading north to Europe again. Do you think that could play any role with how Europe responds or how the West responds?
You're talking about the Syrian refugees?
Well, Syrian refugees or Lebanese refugees, if there's any fighting in there, like there would obviously be a large uptick in people that would be trying to get out of there. And with Europe being on the back door, Turkey as well, that would be a natural option for a lot of people to gravitate to.
Yes, of course. I mean, look, already we know that there is a significant impact of the story of the refugees. You mentioned accurately Turkey, where, and by the way, right now, there has been reports about, I don't want to say the numbers, estimated by thousands. I don't want to say if it's accurate or not, but reports about many Syrian refugees that were in Lebanon that now flee to the northern part of Syria in the areas that are controlled by the Turkish-backed rebels. And it's possible that the next thing they will do will be to knock down on the doors of Turkey. Which I don't want to say that Turkey necessarily will open the door, so to speaking. But also not less significant is to remind ourselves that as you mentioned before, we know that Jordan has been dealing with a massive challenge of the Syrian refugees, I don't know to say whether there is going to be an inflation of that challenge. This is one possible scenario that we'll also have to take into consideration. So definitely, I mean, in such scenario of like a totally fresh mesh, sort of speaking of all the cards, we could expect also that the issue of refugees will become a major factor that basically involving the shaping of this new strategic or geostrategic landscape of the region, and particularly when you talk about the whole complex of Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey, as you mentioned earlier.
Avi Melamed, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Have a good day.
Thank you to Tal and Avi for appearing on the program with us. Even though the war in the Middle East is now over a year old, there are still massive reverberations in Israeli society, in the Middle East, and in the wider world. We at the Trumpet expect Israel to become an increasingly important country of geopolitical significance, as well as one marginalized both in its immediate neighborhood and on the world scene. If you enjoyed today's program, please feel free to like and subscribe. You can follow us on YouTube, X, and Rumble. Our next episode will be this week's Friday Week in Review. And please feel free to write to us at letters@thetrumpet.com.